Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon, and hopefully this week we won't have the cutouts we had last week. Last week I was broadcasting remotely on the road, and when I do that I depend on my iPhone to be a hotspot, that is an internet hotspot, to hook my equipment up. And I always look for a good place where there's good 5G signal, and I thought I had it in every case, but several times last week we had issues. And even the days I didn't know about the issues, some listeners said that there were some cutouts during there. So I'm sorry about that. I didn't know that. It's a shame. I'm back home again, though, and we should have a good solid signal for the foreseeable future. I'm going to have to find some way to get a better internet signal when I'm on the road, because it's not acceptable to have the signal cutting out throughout the show. Anyway, I met wonderful people up in Oregon, had many meetings, as well as teaching for Youth with a Mission. I spoke in five different cities, and every one of them, we met great people. And one of them, we actually met Max the Atheist. You regular listeners know that Max has been calling for a while. And we got a picture together. We had a good talk, but very brief. And I think I'll post that picture on Facebook. Anyway, this Wednesday, we have our monthly Zoom meeting, the first Wednesday of every month. We have a Zoom meeting, and that's open to anybody around the world to join us if they'd like. And that meeting is at 7 o'clock Pacific time. If you want to join us for that, you can look at our website, thenarrowpath.com. And under the announcements tab, you'll find the login information to join us for that. That's a Q&A time. All right, our lines are pretty full. I think we have one line open. The number is 844-484-5737. And we've got some international callers today. But our first caller is from Michigan, which is not international. But Ed from Detroit, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. My question revolves around the marriage supper of the Lamb. One person I read said that means Father God and Israel are the supper. Another one says that's Jesus and the believers. And so I'm looking for some clarification and add to that. Where does present-day believers fit into the marriage supper of the Lamb?
Well, and Paul describes...
I'll take your call off the air. Listen to it on the radio. Unless you have a question you need to ask me.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, God bless you. Thank you.
You too. There are people who think that God is going to remarry Israel, and yet the New Testament makes no mention of any such thing happening. There are some verses in Isaiah that have given people that impression, and Hosea also. But I believe that the remarriage of God to Israel is in the marriage of Christ, who is, in fact, God in flesh, to the remnant of Israel, who are his followers. And therefore, God does marry Israel in the marriage of the Lamb. The Lamb is Christ, of course, and therefore it's not a reference to God the Father, but Jesus. Now, Paul said in 2 Corinthians 11 that we are betrothed to Christ. So we're looking forward to being joined with him in marriage. And in Matthew 22, at the beginning of that chapter, Jesus told a parable about a king that wanted to make a marriage for his son and invited the guests. And this invitation of the guests first involved the Jews and then the Gentiles. And eventually the wedding hall was full of guests. And this is, I believe, fulfilled or being fulfilled in our time, that the gospel invitation is an invitation to be part of this wedding feast. Now, in Revelation chapter 19, we read of the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. And, of course, Revelation is understood various ways. Most people see it probably as a future thing when Jesus comes back. And I think I do, too. I believe that the wedding feast of the Lamb in Revelation 19 is no doubt is the second coming of Christ. That's how I tend to see it. There are various ways to see Revelation, and it's difficult to be dogmatic. Some people think the wedding feast of the Lamb was when Jerusalem was destroyed, and that Israel, the former wife, as it were, of God, was destroyed or divorced. That marriage ended, and he then, you know, took his bride, the church. But I don't think anything happened to the church in 70 AD. Certainly something happened to Israel. I don't read of anything in the Bible that was supposed to happen to the church in 70 AD. And I don't see anything about the church after 70 AD that was spiritually different than the church as it was seen before 70 AD. So I'm not one of those who sees the marriage supper as 70 AD. I tend to think that this is when we actually meet Jesus face to face at his coming and are joined with him. And as Paul says, and we shall forever be with the Lord. That's what I take to be the wedding supper. And it's not so much the Father being married to Israel as Christ, who is, of course, God with us, taking the remnant of Israel, which is the church, as his own. I appreciate your call. We're going to talk next to Peter, calling from the UK. Hi, Peter. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. So a close relative of mine, he's a minister at a particular church, and he also owns a business, and it's been taking a toll on his marriage of 20 years, and his wife has essentially filed for a divorce because his ministry and also the business he's run, he's not had much time on his for his family. Mm-hmm. Now they both met at the church. He grew up there, and the stance he's taking is, he feels this is where God wants him to be. And I'm not taking sides, but obviously I know that you can only give a response based on what I've said. But mm-hmm. there are obviously scriptures that you could use to sort of back a position of, if God's calling you to do something, you need to be loyal to him. But there's also scriptures that talk about the importance of, raising a family. And, I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on the limited information I've given you.
Yeah, there are scriptures that could go both ways about this. That is, scriptures that one might interpret as saying you need to put your ministry first, and other scriptures that would suggest you need to put your family first and your wife first, your marriage first. Paul made it very clear that for a person to be a leader in the church, a pastor or an elder, his family had to be in order. He had to have a wife who is, faithful to him, and children that were obedient. And therefore, it would seem, that being the case, that the wife and the husband being of one mind and having a good, solid marriage actually qualifies a man to be in the ministry. If he can't keep his wife happy, then Paul said, if he can't manage his household, how can he manage the church? And so it does sound like a man who's got, let's just say, a high maintenance marriage needs to make sure he does all that he can to keep it, to keep his wife, on board and keep her happy and keep her as a partner. And if he fails in this, he might see that as God, letting him know that it's time to step out of the ministry and work on that marriage, hopefully win it back. Now, I'm not saying he could never be a pastor again if his marriage is recovered, or even years down the line, if she divorces him and marries someone else and he ends up, going on with his life, perhaps after a certain period of time, there's no reason he wouldn't be able someday to be in that ministry again. But at this time where his wife is threatening divorce, I would, if I were him, I would have to say, I need to really find out which of my activities can be and should be diminished or cut back in order to keep my wife happy. And if it means stepping down from the ministry temporarily in order that the ministry can continue permanently once my family is right, then that would be worthwhile. Now, on the other side of that is, of course, the many things Jesus said about he that loves father or mother or wife or children more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who's left father or mother, wife or children or lands for my sake will receive more in this life and in the next eternal life. I mean, there are definitely cases where the Bible does talk, Jesus talks, about placing him above family members. But I think we might make the mistake of thinking that placing him first means placing our ministries first. To say, well, I'm a pastor. That's my service to God. I can't put my wife above God, so I can't put her above my ministry. Well, that I don't think one's public ministry is the same thing as their relationship with God. And your relationship with God is your obedience to God, and you're putting His priorities first. And therefore, I would say God is first, but the first ministry you have, I think, is to your family. He's got a business and a ministry and a family. And apparently the family's of the three, the one that's taking the hit. He might ask himself whether he could, turn over the management of his business to somebody else for a while he works on his family. And maybe he'd have time to do some of the ministry. He's going to step out of the ministry if the family is being supported by his business. But if he's a man of God, there should be room for him in the ministry in the future, even if he has to step down. You know, my ministry was curtailed back in, 2001, I think it was, when my wife left and left me with four kids at home. And I had to be single dad for 10 years. And I stepped out of the ministry, but not for 10 years. I stepped out of the ministry, until it was clear that my wife was not going to come back, and she eventually remarried somebody else and so forth. And I stayed single for 10 years, but I went back in the ministry after the first year of being out of it. Not that I insisted upon it. It's just that people started asking me to come and minister, and I had to consider whether that was the right thing to do. Since I'm not a pastor and do not intend to be a pastor, I don't consider that the qualifications for being a pastor apply to every ministry. And I've often said on the air that if someone asked me to be a pastor or an elder, I probably would say I don't think I qualify because of that situation with my family. But obviously there's other ministries a man can be in. But I think if he's a pastor and his family's on the rocks, he needs to put the family situation first, because his family being falling apart, I believe, can disqualify him for being in the ministry.
Yeah. It's a sad, hopefully thing they reconcile. But no, Steve, thanks for your insight and also opening up about what you've been through in the past as well. So appreciate that.
I'm sorry to hear this happening to him. It's a terrible thing. But I mean, he might generally be neglecting his wife. She might be jealous of the ministry. I mean, a man who doesn't neglect his wife, she might have any number of problems besides, the one she says is the problem. But some women may be jealous of the ministry no matter how much time he's spending with his wife and family. But if he's got a business and a ministry and she says we're not getting enough time as a family, if I were him, I'd say she might have a reasonable statement, though for her to divorce him is not reasonable, but for her to pressure him and say, listen, this is something, being neglected in your life that God doesn't want you to neglect. So anyway, it's always hard to make those choices, especially when you feel called to the ministry. But I felt called to the ministry, but I had to step down. I mean, no one asked me to, no one made me step down. I just thought I better because my family needs attention. But anyway, God can restore him to ministry, even if his wife never comes back. Yeah, he needs to try to get her back.
Oh, thanks again, Steve, for taking my call.
Okay,
God bless
Peter.
You.
All right, God bless you too, man. Bye now.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, let's see, our next caller is, I'm going to go to Andy in Thailand, since we just talked to England, and Andy's been waiting near the beginning of the program. Andy, welcome. Good to hear from you again. Long time. What's been over a year since you've called?
Yeah. Well, you have a good memory. Thanks for taking my call. I had been reading some other Greek literature lately, and I was just curious. It seems like a lot of the Greek stories, Alexander the Great and Plato and even Caesar Augustus, their mothers were impregnated by God, not Yahweh, but their God, whichever one. And I was curious why, when we read our Greek New Testaments, why we take ours literally, as if it really happened and not theirs. Hopefully that makes sense, what I'm asking.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in the case of Alexander the Great, I don't think anyone claimed that he was virgin-born until at least 400 years after his lifetime. And I think it's probably the same with any Caesars or other kings. Sometimes legends grow up around a person in the centuries, a great person who did mighty things. People come up with ideas. Certainly the Romans tended to think of their emperors as gods. Sometimes the emperors required them to think of them as gods because mm-hmm. they had many gods. So did the Greeks. The difference is the Jews didn't have many gods. The idea that that a man could be birthed of God was almost as bizarre to a Jewish mind as to a Muslim today. I mean, the great objection that Muslims have to saying that Jesus is the Son of God is they cannot conceive of a their God, Allah, consorting with a woman. And, of course, they're thinking in terms of sexual relations between God and woman, which, again, the Romans and the Greeks, their myths, you know, had that as a feature. I mean, Zeus would sleep with women in their mm-hmm. mythology and so forth. So after the fact, you know, maybe Julius Caesar, certainly Alexander the Great, mythologies arose about them hundreds of years after their deaths that included miraculous elements of their lives that no one in their lifetime or shortly afterwards would claim ever were true. The difference is, first of all, again, the Jews are much less likely to fabricate a thing like that. They don't need it. I mean, the Messiah was not necessarily expected to be born of a virgin. I know that Isaiah 7:14 is sometimes quoted about it. Even Matthew quotes it, but not all the Jews believed that Isaiah 7:14 was necessarily talking about the Messiah. And therefore, I mean, David was not born of a virgin, and they thought the Messiah was going to be like David. So, in other words, the Christians didn't have to make up a virgin birth if it didn't really happen. It wasn't really a Jewish idea at all, particularly. So the fact that they recorded it puts it in a very different class than any kind of mythologies about Roman or Greek heroes, because their religions had Roman and Greek gods that, again, cohabited with women and had babies. The Yahweh did not. And Yahweh, of course, did not have a sexual relationship with Mary, but he miraculously placed a zygote in her womb so that he could visit us through that agency. That is, coming through the human race so that he could be the second Adam to redeem the race that the first Adam had ruined. Anyway, the point is that this is not the kind of story that would have originated among Jews unless they had a true belief that it happened. And the story is told by those who knew Jesus. In other words, it's not like hundreds of years later they decided to come up with all these myths about Jesus. No, the Gospels record all these miracles about Jesus in the lifetime of the apostles. And I realize that you're going to find some internet sites that say, no, these Gospels were written much later. Those are based on skeptical scholarship of a previous generation. Even the non-Christian scholarship today almost always thinks that the Gospels were written by people in the first generation after Christ. All the evidence is there in the Gospels themselves and historic cross-references. I mean, anyone who says otherwise simply is following old news from previous generations, bad research or bad theories. Yeah, so I mean, that you have the people who knew Jesus saying that he did these miracles in their presence. And that's another thing, too. The virgin birth fits the general character of a man whose whole life was miraculous, who worked wonders, who raised dead people, opened the eyes of the blind, raised from the dead himself, that he might have been born of a virgin if anyone ever in history was miraculously so born is very considerably it's as realistic as the suggestion that he rose from the dead. Now, some people say, well, that's not realistic either, but it certainly is, given his whole life, miraculous life. But the point is, there's nothing less likely than that he was born of a virgin than he was raised from the dead. And so there's certainly, as some people say, some people think that the stories of the Gospels were mimicking the stories of people like Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and others that are right. allegedly born of virgins. But those stories about them were not told about them anywhere near their lifetimes. This is only after they were lionized in the memory of history and in the pagan religions. Again, Rome and Greece both had pagan gods that came down and slept with women more than once. So in the Christian faith, which came out of Judaism, there's only one occasion when Yahweh actually came to earth as a man and did so through the womb of a woman, and it is unique. And then it's very possible, I mean, we don't know, but the stories of these other guys, which certainly came after the time of Jesus, might have been mimicking him. Sometimes people say, well, the stories of Jesus are mimicking the pagan gods. Actually, if you check it out, we don't have any record of these myths of the pagan gods until a time much later than the time of Christianity. That's these ideas that, you know, Horus or Mithras mm-hmm. or, you know, Krishna or whatever were said to have some kind of features in their stories that resemble that of Christ. And therefore, the assumption that since these deities or these religions are older than Christianity, that Christianity must have mimicked them in telling the story of Christ is pretty much put to rest by the fact that we don't have any records of these teachings in these pagan religions until long after the time of Christ. Once Christianity became dominant in the Roman Empire, then we begin to have myths about Mithras and Dionysius and so forth that might resemble the stories of Jesus. But that's after Christianity was well known and accepted throughout the empire. So, you know, people need to pay attention to the historical sources. And I don't think the cases you gave bring any suspicions about the historicity of the virgin birth of Christ.
Well, I think in the case of Caesar Augustus, who was Caesar, I think, for the first half of Jesus' life. I think he uh-huh. died when Jesus was a teenager. They called him Son of God. It's on his coins. And his father being God seems to have been, everybody knew it at the time of, during the time of his life. They called him Son of God.
Yeah. Many of the Caesars claimed to be spawned by gods. And I don't know how many, maybe there were people in Augustus's time that called him Son of God. There are certainly those who called him God. He called himself God. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the pagan religions, this was not strange. I know that in the case of Alexander the Great, miracles, the miraculous elements, I think were invented, like, I think it was 400 years after his death. But I don't know mm-hmm. about Augustus when they began to call him that. But it's not surprising in the Roman world or the Greek world for kings to refer to themselves as the sons of Zeus or Apollo or, you know, their gods. That was a commonplace. But among Jews, for a person to be spawned, as it were, by Yahweh, that's a unique case that's very out of character with their general religion.
Okay. When you say Jews... isn't the New Testament written by Greek writers?
No. Only one Greek wrote anything in the New Testament. That was Luke. All the others were Jews.
Okay. Okay.
And
great.
And many of them were Palestinian Jews who walked with Jesus. Certainly Matthew was, John was, Mark lived contemporary with Jesus in Palestine and probably saw him, though he wasn't an apostle. Paul, of course, didn't see Jesus in his lifetime, but he was converted and then hung out among the 12 who were with Jesus. So, I mean, these people are pretty close to the situation, and they were Jewish in their worldviews.
Oh, yes, that reminds me. Neither Paul or our first gospel, Mark, mentions the virgin birth, but I guess they didn't need to mention it. But it is interesting that it's seems to have been written down a little bit later.
Not right. Only Luke and Matthew mention the virgin birth. John doesn't mention it either. But John does mention that Jesus was God come into the world. He didn't mention the childhood of Jesus. See, Mark and John simply don't mention anything about the childhood of Jesus. They both begin the story at the point where Jesus is alive and adult and starts his ministry. So his birth isn't mentioned, nor his childhood. Matthew and Luke both mention his birth and childhood, and both mention him being virgin born.
Okay, great. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Okay, Andy, good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Bye now. All right, let's see. We're coming up on a break here. Maybe I shouldn't. I better not take another call till after the break. I don't want to have to cut it in the middle. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you've never been to our website or haven't gotten our mobile app, you might want to do that. We've got hundreds and hundreds, well, over 1,000 anyway, audio lectures of my teaching verse by verse through the whole Bible, as well as on many, many hundreds of topics, the kind of topics that people ask questions about here on the air. Only these lectures are much longer answers. And if you want some in-depth teaching on almost any biblical topic, you'll find it there, and it's free. It's at thenarrowpath.com. Also, the app is The Narrow Path app. And so you can get that for both of your Android or your iPhones. We are listener-supported, and if you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Now, we have another half hour coming up. We're not done. And we'll be taking your calls. We have one line open if you want to call and get on. The number is 844-484-5737. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Take the Narrow Path with you everywhere on your phone or other device by downloading our app from the App Store or from Google Play. You can listen to the radio broadcasts live or later from the app, as well as many other lectures posted at our website. Search for the app by typing the same name as the website, The Narrow Path, and enjoy the learning experience. It's rare to get such good stuff for free these days.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have another half hour of live broadcasting today. We're going to take your calls during this whole half hour, as we did in the first half hour. I want you to be aware that on Wednesday, and the first Wednesday of every month, and that would be this Wednesday this month, or I should say next month, we have a Zoom meeting in the evening that anyone is welcome to join. Peter from the UK call earlier in the program today. He's joined us from there, although the time of the day is 7 p.m. Pacific time, and over in England, I think that's like 1 in the morning or something for him. He doesn't always join us, but you can, wherever you are in the world, if you happen to be awake at what would be 7 p.m. Pacific time, if you want to do so, it's a Q&A Zoom meeting. And you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, under announcements to see how you would log in and join us for that virtual gathering. All right, let's talk to Arnold from Pittsburgh, California. Arnold, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make a suggestion, and I also wanted to ask a question.
Okay.
I know this past Friday you had an atheist call. He was asking a bunch of questions and all that, and wanted to ask, have you heard of presuppositional apologetics?
I have.
Okay, yeah, I would recommend using that against him, because he speaks as if there is something wrong with controlling someone. You know, I don't see him complaining about, I don't know, chimps controlling other chimps or something like that, you know. So why is he
humans? If that's how I feel led, I'll resort to presuppositional apologetics. I like to talk to the person where they're at and interact with what they say. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, true. And the question is, I haven't seen it yet, but the movie Jesus Revolution, is there any scene that you should be coming on? I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I've seen it 3 times. I was privileged to preview it a couple times before it came to the theaters, and then I went and saw it in the theater on, I think it was Saturday. Actually, I like the movie very much. Okay. It not everything about it is strictly the way it happened, but a lot of times it's just compressing the story. I thought it was interesting it showed Lonnie Frisbee and Greg Laurie and a bunch of Christians watching the moon landing, which I don't remember what year that was, but that was in the 60s. And I mean, and yet for some reason they showed them watching it, and this was, of course, 1970 or 71. So, I mean, that kind of that's strange. You know, in the movie, Chuck Smith's daughter sees Lonnie Frisbee walking on the road and picks him up. Actually, in real life, it was her boyfriend who was out and picked up Lonnie and brought him to Chuck's house. But they left Chuck's her boyfriend out of the movie, and I was surprised they left people like Chuck Smith Jr. out of the movie. Chuck, you know, you get the impression he only had one child there, and he actually had several. Some of them were significant, you know. But the movie had to, you know, had to leave some things out just because so many things happened. You can't put them all into a movie. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if he was in there, but I forget his name. The author of Kingdom of the Cults. Did you ever meet him?
I met Walter Martin once, and I listened to him on the radio when he was on the air. Mm-hmm. I went to hear him a few times, but yeah, we weren't acquaintances really. I was a kid. A kid when he was, you know, in the '70s.
Because I know he was He was part of that. Well, later on, wasn't he? To my understanding, I mean, I know he moved to Southern California for that reason.
Well, I don't remember why or when he moved to Southern California, but I do remember that very early in the Jesus movement, like must have been 1970 or 71, his radio show, the Bible Answerment, began. It began the Jesus movement in Southern California. So it was part. His show was part of the movement, but but he was mainly a cult expert he had a ministry in that time period, but he wasn't one of the main leaders of the movement like Chuck Smith and Lonnie were. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, Arnold. And by the way, I hope everyone will go see that movie. I thought it was interesting. You know, we hear about revivals going on right now at Asbury and Texas A&M, and I think there's a couple other colleges around the country that have reported revivals breaking out just now. And here this movie was being made probably for a year or two at least, and they had no idea that it would be released at the very time that these alleged revivals are happening. I say alleged because I haven't seen them, but I'm taking at face value that these are real revivals. It's interesting that this movie would come out at that time because it's also receiving a lot of attention, and it deserves it. It's really a tremendous movie. And, of course, as someone who was actually at Calvary Chapel in the years that it is documenting there. I was a teenager, you know, I wasn't anyone important there. But having been there for most of the events that are in the movie, it was very moving, a very moving movie to me. I found myself getting choked up a lot. All right, let's talk to Aaliyah from Arlington, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. First, I want to thank you for your ministry. My family and I have personally grown a lot through your teaching, and we really appreciate all the work you pour into it.
Well, thank you.
And I apologize if you've already addressed this question. I haven't been able to listen for the last couple of weeks, and I've looked on Matthew 7:13 under the topic of revival, and I haven't seen anything recently.
Revival.
But... yeah, and especially with Asbury and all the other revivals that are happening.
Right.
And my concern is there's a lot of mainly Reformed churches that are denying that it's actual revival and are very skeptical. And my personal view is that it's okay to be skeptical, but we should be hopeful in prayer when viewing this. And my church in particular, it's a Reformed church. Very Calvinistic. I feel like the lone non-Calvinist there. But they are, today at our church, they're going to be speaking on what's happening. And they're going to be showing a movie called Revival, The Work of God. It's about an hour and a half movie. But they're going to have a half-hour discussion beforehand. And my question for you is, how would I address this situation? My concern is that they could possibly be grieving the Holy Spirit by denying that this is a work of the Spirit and that it's just mere work of man and possibly even cults or something demonic.
Well, there is always that possibility. I mean, there have been, in my lifetime, since the Jesus movement, there have been a number of things like the Toronto Blessing and the Brownsville, Florida revival, supposed revival, that people have referred to as revivals, but which I have not been impressed by as revivals. So, I mean, there's always, you always have to use discernment when something special and attention-getting is happening in the body of Christ. You have to be careful not to call everything a revival, because I think sometimes they're not. As for the Asbury one and the others that are going on around the country, I don't have the details about them to know. I've heard nothing about them that would make me skeptical about them, but I realize that there are things that people call revivals that aren't. Now, the difficulty is that the Bible doesn't give any teachings about revivals. The Bible describes a revival that took place at Pentecost and in the early decades of the church. That we could certainly call that a revival, but it wasn't even revival. It was more the birth and growth of the church that had many of the features that revivals have. But when we talk about revival, we're not talking about something that the Bible uses that word and gives some kind of a definition of that word or describes what it is. Again, reviving, I suppose at its best, revives the features that were in the early church, which the church has drifted away from in many cases. But what we would say about revivals would have to be based on the history of revivals. And if somebody says, well, that's not a revival because revivals should have this or that, there's really no biblical basis for saying a revival should have this or that. In other words, for example, I've heard some people say, well, I'm not seeing people getting saved. I'm just seeing Christians worshiping God obsessively. And that's not a revival, because a revival, people become Christians. And I don't know if there's a lot of people becoming Christians out there in Asbury. I don't know. Another thing you might hear is that, revivals don't just make the church get bigger. Real revivals, change society. I mean, in the times of Finney and even Moody and Wesley, whole towns would be converted. The bars would close. There was no one in jail for months at a time. The police had nothing to do, sort of like the Maytag repairman. It's like wonderful things happen sometimes in some revivals. And so, there's lots of things that can be part of a revival. And, the best we could hope for would be all these things would happen in a revival, that Christians become more worshipful, more holy, have more of a sense of God's reality in their lives. There's non-Christians being converted. The society is beginning to have more of a godly flavor, because the consciences even of the unconverted are aroused, and so forth. I mean, those things happen in many revivals. But if we say, well, it's not a revival if this element is missing or that element is missing, because we don't really have any right to say what a revival must have or must not have. Because, again, we don't have any teaching about revivals in the Bible. We just have examples. So if you're, if the Reformed Church that you're talking about has said, well, we don't recognize revival unless it has this element, and we're not seeing that element there, well, then they have, I suppose, the right to use the word revival the way they want to use it and to define it the way they want to define it. That doesn't require the rest of us to agree with their definition. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if, let's just say, months go by and there's no particular significant conversions because the revival is waking up the Christians and making them take God seriously for the first time in their lives, and they're praying more and they're obedient more and they're convicted about holiness more, I mean, if that's all there is, that's a wonderful thing. But I would expect, if that does go on for weeks or months, that there will be also people being converted. Because I don't know of any time in history when Christians got revived personally and it didn't harvest a lot of souls of non-Christians as well. And if that happens, then eventually, if it does, if it goes long enough and if it's deep enough and the conversions are genuine enough, then you probably do begin to see a difference in the color, the moral coloring of society. I mean, one thing leads to another, but the first thing that has to happen is the Christians themselves have to become saved. They have to take God seriously. They need to become holy and obedient and prayerful and so forth. And if that's happening, and if none of the other features are happening yet, well, I just say, well, let's wait and see. That's why I'm not really commenting on it. But it sounds to me like what is going on is a good thing. Now maybe you're the Reformed people who are talking bad about it. Maybe they've gone there and seen some alarming things. I don't know. I'm not aware of anything alarming going on. But I will say this. Those who write about revivals, about the history of revivals, because there have been very many of them, and they're not all alike, though many of them have similar features. One thing I've read from them is that in a revival, the first person who wakes up is the devil. He's the first one revived because he wants to corrupt it. He wants to misguide it. He wants to distract people, take the zeal that they now have and misguide it to a peripheral direction so it doesn't really have any impact. The devil counterfeits miracles and all kinds of stuff. And this has been true in essentially every revival that I've read about. And now maybe that's happening there. I haven't heard about any of that. But I wouldn't be surprised if it did happen. I wouldn't think if there was some demonic activity that's kind of on the periphery of this thing, that would disqualify what's going on as a revival. It would almost make it like, a normal revival, because the devil doesn't just let things go on without raising up some opposition, even in the book of Acts. I can't state anything except what I've heard, and what I've heard is only general. I haven't been to Kentucky or to see it or anything, so people want to know my opinion, but I'd have to know more than the average person to really have an opinion that I could be confident about. And my information is pretty much through the channels that we usually hear. And I'm not doing a lot of special inquiry into it. People send me emails and things like that, but I haven't had time or the luxury to, deeply investigate it. But if it is real, it should, awareness of it should force itself upon us eventually. And we could see the results of it, whether we deeply investigate it or not. It'll be before our eyes as something unavoidable to acknowledge. So, yeah, I don't know what to say in that half hour they have before the movie. And the movie might be good. But I will say this, if they have some good objections to this and say this can't be a revival because of this or that, I don't know what those would be. But if you want to email me some of those, I'd be curious to read about them or hear about them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Okay, Aaliyah, thanks for your call. God bless you. And, if you don't like what they're doing, I don't know, maybe there's another church somewhere that isn't so critical. But on the other hand, paying attention and even being critical of things that are claimed to be revivals is helpful. The Bible says, test all things and hold fast that which is good. When the Toronto blessing thing was happening, and the Kansas City Prophets thing, and the Brownsville, Florida thing was happening. All of those were called revivals. When I looked into them, I had concerns about them, but they were concerns that were very different than I would see, for example, in the Jesus movement, or than I have yet seen in what I've heard about the current college awakenings that are going on. It's too early for me to know what to think of them. I'm hopeful. I'm positively hopeful about them. But if there's reasons for alarm, I would not mind being informed of it, since I'm not doing the research myself at this moment. Mark from Detroit, Michigan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. How are you doing today?
Good.
Hey, I got a real quick question about it. I believe it's Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 11.
Uh-huh.
Where it's talking about the future where the daily will be taken away from the Jewish people. And in italicized word, in my Bible, it says that means sacrifices. And
now,
I was listening to some...
Wait. I don't see that in Ezekiel 3:11. I don't see anything about that. It says, go and get the captives to the children of your people and speak to them. Tell them, thus says the Lord your God, whether they hear it or whether they refuse. What are you referring to? The daily sacrifices being taken away? Okay, you're talking about Daniel 12:11.
Yeah, that's why I got a great memory to recall I got a problem with.
Okay, so what's the issue?
Yeah, Daniel, my apologies. I was listening to some elderly rabbis, and they were saying how they were having a round table. They were talking about this word, and they said it didn't mean sacrifices. It really meant prayers, that their prayers would be taken away, not sacrifices, because that's what the Jewish people did every day is prayed. They did sacrifice every day.
Okay, so what's your question?
Have you ever heard anything like that?
Well, no,
that,
I don't.
The daily doesn't mean sacrifices, it actually means prayers.
I doubt that the word in Hebrew means prayers, but the fact that sacrifices, prayers are a type of sacrifice. You know, David said, let my prayer be unto you as incense, you know, which incense is something that was offered in the temple. He was likening his prayers to the offering up of incense to God. So, I mean, the rabbis might think in terms of the sacrifice being taken away as referring to a spiritual kind of a sacrifice, meaning prayers. But, you know, the passage, I believe, is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, as near as I can tell, and his destruction or his defilement of the temple in 168 BC, so that the sacrifices did cease for a period of time, for about 3 years or so, because it was defiled by this man sacrificing a pig on an altar to Zeus in the temple in, I think it was 168 BC, and then that was Antiochus Epiphanes, and then the Jews wouldn't use the temple. They stopped offering sacrifices until it could be cleansed again, but they first had to drive the Syrians out, and that's what the Maccabean war accomplished. And then they started sacrificing again. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know why Jews would say that it's prayers, but, I mean, rabbis, you know, they have their own opinions about things. Being a rabbi doesn't mean you know more about the Old Testament than a Christian would necessarily. I mean, they might. A rabbi should know something, obviously, they're trained, but Christians are sometimes trained too, and it may be that you'll find a Christian scholar who's read the Old Testament as much or more than a rabbi in his lifetime. So the fact that someone's a rabbi doesn't impress me that much, especially since rabbis disagree with each other on a great number of things, of important things. Judaism is a very fractured religion, just like Christianity is. I mean, it's got its divisions. And so if someone says, well, a rabbi said this, I think, okay, that's interesting. But I don't think it's particularly authoritative just because he's a rabbi. Tim from La Mesa, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. I'm trying to activate Tim's. Okay. Studio, could you activate Tim's for call? Thank you. Gotcha. Hey, Tim. You there?
I'll hold my original question for another day.
Okay.
First one is, I'm like 1.7 years younger than you, and I was in the Catholic Charismatic Renewal in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And I used to listen to Hank Hanegraaff on the radio, and I bought one of his books. I believe it was called Counterfeit Revival.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you were familiar with that.
Well, I'm familiar with him. I'm familiar with him and his position on that. Yeah, he was. I think that book was primarily about the New Age. The Word of Faith movement, and I've also got lectures against the Word of Faith movement. I haven't read his book, but I've read Word of Faith teachers, and I've responded to them just like Hank has. My position about the Word of Faith would be the same as his. So whatever he said in that book, I'd be favorable toward.
What I remember from it was that it also criticized the so-called slaying in the Holy Spirit, the slaying in the Holy Spirit as being sometimes.
Okay, I was thinking that was his book about the Word of Faith. No, that was probably about the Toronto and Brownsville.
Yes.
Phenomenal. Okay.
Right.
But I would feel the same way he would about that for the most part. Yeah.
Okay. My other quick question is, I just heard about that Jesus Revolution movie, and I looked up Lonnie Frisbee, and the article I read didn't sound too favorable. It sounded like he was a practicing homosexual all his life and was, you know, partying on Saturday and preaching on Sunday. And I don't know, you probably met him or something, but what did you think of him?
I knew him reasonably well. He did not identify as a homosexual. He did have, in his childhood, he was, over a period of years, sexually molested by a male babysitter that his parents left him with, and he did struggle with homosexual desires, and he did fall to that at times, both before he was a Christian, and then later he did backslide and fell into that some a little bit. But he did not, he never identified as a homosexual. He married a woman. They got divorced, but not because anything related to homosexuality. He fell away from the Lord for a while and fell into various things, but including I think some heterosexual relationships. But when he came back to the Lord, he was engaged to a woman when I last saw him. I didn't see him in his final hours. Some friends of mine were with him near his final hours, and they said he wasn't a practicing homosexual. You know, the fact that he fell into homosexual sex partly due to the brokenness of his condition from childhood, you know, Christians like to make big scandals about homosexuality, let's face it. But homosexuality is one problem that some Christians have. Others have heterosexual problems. And Lonnie had probably both. But when he was walking with God, he wasn't practicing either of those behaviors. In the years that he was at Calvary Chapel, he was living pure, I believe. I mean, everyone I know who was with him all that time, some traveled with him, they said he was not practicing any kind of fornication, homosexual or heterosexual during those times. So he was a weak man who got saved out of a very sinful past. He served God with zeal and with integrity, as far as I know. And then later, some years later, he fell away for reasons that I think I know, but I won't go into now. And he did succumb to those temptations again. But before he died, he did die of AIDS. Before he died, he came back to the Lord, and he was planning to go back. He was hoping the Lord would heal him, and he was hoping to go back into preaching the gospel. He was a very powerful evangelist, and when he was preaching, he was sincere. I mean, the fact that a man falls doesn't mean he was never sincere. He was a weak man. There's no question about it. He had weaknesses, but he also had great power that God used through him. So, of course, the movie only deals with Lonnie Frisbee from about, you know, 1969 through maybe 1971, maybe 72. And, Lonnie wasn't a practicing homosexual at that time. And again, he never identified as a homosexual. He succumbed to temptations when he was not with the Lord. But even then, I guess we'd have to say more bisexual, because his real identity in his own mind was heterosexual. So anyway, yeah, there's a lot of people like to criticize Lonnie. He was a colorful character and therefore controversial. But, you know, and it is a shame. It is a shame that he fell, but he also came back. So Lonnie, you know, repented before he went to heaven. But the movie is not about the time when he was in any sense compromised, except that he was a little more, the fame did go to his head a little bit, and the movie points that out. I mean, the movie is a little critical of him, but it's pretty accurate, I think. So I think the movie's largely favorable toward Lonnie and Chuck, though it shows perhaps an imperfect side of both of them, which is, I thought, was a strength of the movie, because they were not one-dimensional, you know, saints. They were real people, and the movie depicts them as real people. Hey, I'm out of time, I'm sorry to say, because there's people waiting. We'll have to talk to you tomorrow. Call tomorrow. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.